Tom.
Thank you.
Unless anybody else has anything to come before us for today's agenda, we are through to the listening session. Is there anything anybody wants to bring up for today on that? Okay. We will move into the... What's that, John? I'm sorry. Okay, great. All right. Okay,
hi.
What I'm... Hi, Helen. Is this a question that you want us to do? Okay, if you would read it, the main reason, either you or I have to read it, because we have people listening on the system and they won't know what it is.
Oh, that's fine. I just wanted to give you a little background on why I have this question. Ellen Gaethel, I'm fishing vessel Ellen Diane. I also represent the NEFS fishing sectors 11 and 12 in New Hampshire. We've had some concerns about the current observer system, and I know that you are going to be contemplating doing different types of industry-funded requirements for the observer system. And I just want to give you a little background on what happened this past week personally. MREG called our house on Friday and asked if they could speak to David. I said he was out fishing. He said, oh, okay, well, I'm calling everyone on the list who has signed up to fish for Sunday. And when I find someone who's actually going to go, we're going to pick that person, select that person. And I asked him specifically if the whole system was not supposed to be, if it wasn't supposed to be blind and random. And he said, oh, no. We did hear about something like that at the last meeting, but that's far into the future. And then I said, okay, well, he won't know until a little before he leaves on Sunday. But that's the first part of our problem. The second part was that, you know, he had an observer on Sunday, and the observer called him at 5 minutes before he was supposed to leave the dock and said, I'm sitting with a state trooper on 95 and have been stopped. I'm going to be a little late. He arrived down at the dock 25 minutes late, and I said to David, no, he arrived at the dock an hour and 25 minutes late, because I believe they're supposed to be at the dock an hour before departure. And this is a chronic problem. David has had in the past year four observers with flat tires who arrived an hour and a half late, and now the one that was stopped by the police. At the end of the day, when he asked, the observer never told him whether he was an EFOPS observer or a at-sea observer, and he did not have any paperwork for David. David requested a comment card. He said, he didn't have any, and he asked for the paperwork to request his data, and he did not have that. He had no paperwork on him at all. And this is a chronic problem. And I'm going to ask these questions of the council, because if we think there's tension between the observers now and the fishermen, when the fishermen have to start paying for this service, and this is going to continue, if it's not fixed before this happens, the tension is going to be incredible. So here are my questions. The first one is the selection process a blind / random selection, as we were told, or not? The second question, and I'm not sure that you can answer these questions now, but these are questions that I think that the council needs answers to, and probably in writing. The fishermen need the answers in writing. Are the observers or the observer company paid if they miss the boat, which happens fairly frequently. Is their pay docked if they are late and cause the boat to leave the dock late? And that's very important if we're going to be paying for this. The third question is, what protocols are in place to ensure observers have all applicable paperwork for the captains, as I was talking about, the comment cards and the request for data? Or and is there anything to ensure that these observers are on time, because they are chronically late? My fourth and last question is more a statement. I think that observers should be required to have all their paperwork, including their comment cards, the forms for release of information to the captain, and the information on what type of observing is being performed. There should be consequences if they do not follow these protocols. And I did call Amy on Friday as soon as I finished talking to MRAG. I realized she's very busy, and I didn't want to blindside her with this, but I think that these questions are pertinent to the council, and I really needed to bring them to you. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm just going to make a few comments from my standpoint. I couldn't agree more with you. I think that these are fairly basic protocols that the observers should be required to follow, and there should be some sort of, penalty on their side to offset the not only the inconvenience but the cost of the fishermen,
right,
to do that. I don't see Amy here today. So I don't know if we have anybody else from NEPOM, but I see that Bill is raising his hand, so we will get some thoughts from him as well.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Obviously, the council deserves answers to these questions, and there are some real concerns that have been put on the table here. I'm not really prepared to answer them off the top of my head, and I don't want to do that. I want to take some time and work with the staff. So we will respond. And thank you for bringing it to our attention.
Bill, we'll make sure that you get a copy of this with the questions on it. Dave.
Yeah, just to set the record straight, the observer that was stopped was from AIS. AIS grabbed the trip before MRAC could, so just so that people don't think it was... I don't want the wrong company getting blamed. But the other issue that I would like to comment on here is some of us are constrained by draft and in harvest. It's a problem in Chatham. It's a problem in my harbor. We leave at a certain time for a certain reason. When an observer is late and it's low tide like it was the other day, it becomes a matter of safety as well as frustration. So it's a real problem. I understand that... there are a lot of new observers this year. There's a lot of new observers every year. We have protocols for ourselves now. We call it sending Stanley out to find Livingston. A lot of times, I get a call from an observer at, quarter of 5 to 15 minutes late. I can't find the dock. That's because our docks aren't on whatever you call those things people have now. People use GPSs for everything, and the Hampton State Pier is not there. The Hampton River Marina is not there. The nearest thing they can find is the Hampton River Boat Club, which is about 5 miles away. I had to send my crewman up to fetch one out of there at 4 o'clock in the morning one day. There are a lot of continuing issues here, even beyond what my wife put forward here, that really, if we're going to require the industry to pay for these people, as we may do in Herring tomorrow, really need to be addressed sooner rather than later. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ellen. Do we have...
Thank you very much.
Do we have a message? And this is on the telephone? Oh, okay.
Thanks. I don't do this very often. Thank you very much for letting me speak today. My name is Karen Alexander. I'm with the Gulf of Maine Cod Project. We're housed at the University of New Hampshire. But I am speaking as an individual. I would like to say how pleased I am to be here today and to listen to all of the very interesting presentations. I particularly enjoy Dr. Hare's presentation, and it's nice to be reminded of the connection between a stock structure and a habitat and an ecosystem. These animals don't exist in a blank space, and we can't manage them in a blank space. We now manage them over their habitat by law, and these habitat are generally thought of in terms of management areas that were actually originally drawn 80 years ago. In the 1930s, when the ecosystem was quite different, and when fish stocks were quite different. As a historical ecologist, I'm used to dealing in numbers that make current situations seem more depressing to me than they probably even are to you. But while generally I like to talk about historical abundance and historical diversity at situations like this, I'm not going to do that right now. I'm going to talk about the connection between stock structure and habitat and how important it is, and the fact that we are going into a time of very great uncertainty right now with climate change and with all the other ecosystem changes that have taken place, some of which have taken place in my lifetime. I'm 60, and 60 years ago things were a whole lot better than they are now, particularly for the oceans. During periods of time like this, we need to be flexible. And we need to think about how to adapt the way that we do things now to reflect the realities of the present. And in that light, I'd like to say that I was very honored to participate in the GMRI Cod Stock Structure Workshop last week. It was the first time historical information has ever been presented at a workshop like that, and I was very, very honored to be asked to present information about historical stock structure. There were wonderful papers presented, and a lot of really great scientific information on the fact, and it all pretty much agreed. Sure, there's some uncertainty. Sure, some more work needs to be done, but there was pretty general agreement in the fact that there were three separate structures, and that the tagging studies also corroborated that fact, and that there was some overlap between the southern New England cod structure and north of Cape Cod and south of Cape Cod, that there was a northern stock genetically, and then that there was a stock on Georgia's Bank. Wednesday evening, it looked like we were going to return something pretty exciting out of committee. It looked like we were going to have a consensus that that might actually change some things. And then Thursday, wanted to maintain the status quo, prevented a strong resolution from coming out of committee. And that was very frustrating and discouraging to the rest of us who wanted to see some change. Nothing was presented that really contradicted the testimony of the previous 2 days. Generally, what was said was that there was too much uncertainty, that there was more information needed to be had, that more studies needed to be done, and that we couldn't decide anything right now. We needed to wait. And I would like to state that if you look at things historically, and if you look at the carrying capacity of cod in the Gulf of Maine, you see that right now all of the different goals that we're talking about in terms of stock restoration are 15% or less of the carrying capacity, and in terms of catch right now, we're talking about less than 2% of carrying capacity. And I will submit that possibly the ecosystem is capable of doing a little better than that, even in the light of climate change and even in the light of the loss of probable genetic stocks. I think we need to give the ecosystem the chance to be better. And I think we need to aim higher, and I think we need to be willing to make some of these changes in protocol and changes in models perhaps, maybe we need to draw some of these 80-year-old lines to try to reflect conditions today and to try to reflect what we would like to see in the future. Thank you.
Karen, thank you for that. I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
If there's one part of this, I mean, you covered quite a bit of ground in your comments, and whether from our standpoint it was focused on being informational or there were parts of this that you wanted some comment and thoughts back from the council on.
Well, I'd like y'all to think about it. I don't know if you can, if you want to comment now, that's fine. I guess what I wanted to say is what I sometimes do in these situations is to give you perhaps an alternative perspective that that might be useful in deciding some of these things. You all have an extraordinary honor and responsibility for maintaining and enhancing and preserving something for future generations, and I so thoroughly respect what you do and admire it, and I because I know you're doing it for me and for everybody else who has a stake in these things, and as a citizen, I'm just giving my commentary because I would like you to think about that. So you don't have to give me any opinions or anything, but you can if you want to.
Well, just a couple of quick comments. One is that it is a goal of this council to, as soon as we get out of the trenches that we're currently in with some of the crises we're dealing with, to have much more of an ecosystem-based approach as to, mm-hmm. to how we manage. I think I've always said when we had sort of our first presentation and discussions with Mike Fogarty, I think it's a great idea and it's a wonderful concept. From a practical standpoint, the problems that we have are getting from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, we are thinking about mm-hmm. these things. And perhaps in reality, not thinking about them enough because of the day-to-day problems that we are dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I sort of look at your comment of Menhaden and mm-hmm. and Alewife being functionally extinct,
mm-hmm.
And I plead ignorance on what the meaning of functionally extinct is. I mean, from an anecdotal standpoint, this year was a year. I mean, it had been some terrible years,
mm-hmm.
but this year there were some great returns to a number of Maine rivers. I think some New Hampshire as well.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, there were great returns. Well, what I mean by that is it has to do with historical abundance and distribution. And 50 years ago, but certainly 100 years ago, there was generally about 10 times what there is now. And it went, and a lot of it was inshore. The inshore ecosystem was extraordinary, with cod, tuna, swordfish, alewives, herring, menhaden, pretty much anything you would want within 20 miles of land.
And Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick follow-up, ask Bill. It's my understanding that this workshop was you sponsored in response to the council's request to look at cod structuring. And so when will the council, and I heard the same review that Karen gave by a member that my staff that attended the meeting. So what is the next step? And when will the council be briefed on kind of the summary of the key points of the meeting?
Mr. Chairman, Paul, the workshop took place last week, and I'm just beginning to hear some reports from the workshop myself. It depends somewhat on the recommendations. We had, I think, an open... First of all, it was convened by GMRI, and John Aller, who's sitting in the audience there, actually chaired the meeting. It was supported by the agency, and so it's a cooperative exercise from that point of view. My mind is open on this with regard to whether this is... whether the recommendations that come from here are adequate to allow us to move on, or whether there are recommendations which lead to more actions that need to be taken. And so I would like to wait to see the report from the meeting before providing a full response.
Doug.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had the opportunity on Thursday to stop by the last day of the workshop and just to see if there was going to what had transpired from this. I didn't get to see the individual presentations on the data, and I know the process started off with a straw man statement that was put forward, and it was a moderately strong statement that indicated that there. That suggested that there was substantial evidence from a variety of areas that there could be different stock structures than what we've historically used. The thing that was, I always see scientists always are at their best when they're debating and you have both sides pushing each other and challenging each other, but what this group was trying to do was come up with a consensus statement. And by the time the end of the workshop had occurred, that consensus statement had been significantly weakened because of some concerns that were brought up by a relatively small group of people there. And it was just, from my standpoint, it was very interesting to see the process that it went through there, and I'll be interested to see with this type of statement that's come forward. I understand this is phase one, and there's an anticipated phase two as to where we go with phase two on this. So just my comments and my observations from being there.
Great. Thank you. Dave?
Yeah. I'm on the steering committee of that, and there's going to be a working draft. I'd have to ask John. I think it's by Friday is the goal. So we don't have a working draft yet, so it's a little bit hard to comment on exactly what statement is coming out, but I think Doug's description of what happened is accurate. And I think there was frustration that's being expressed by Dr. Alexander on behalf of some people there with the outcome of the process. But as Doug said, it was a consensus process for whatever reason. Maybe that's just how these things are done. And there were a relative handful of people that appeared not to be able to reach strong consensus. And I think that's all we can really say at this time.
Okay, well, thank you for all that feedback, and thank you, Karen, for your comments. Joan, do we have anything from anybody on the line? Okay. Anyone in the audience have anything for us? Well, we...
You
tried. No, we... But Paul wanted to tell a couple more jokes. But I think I'm gonna tell him to keep his day job. So given that, well, thank you for those who brought your thoughts before us, and we will see people tomorrow morning. Again, we will reconvene at 8:30 a.m. for a day of herring.
Oh boy.
Yeah, what also council members, we were just going to convene upstairs for a chance to have a little social time with our departing members. Okay. And it's not on the council.